This is Josh Barrow, and welcome to Left, Right, and Center, your civilized yet provocative antidote to the self-contained opinion bubbles that dominate political debate. It's the first week of September, the summer silly season is over, and this week the news was sensible and serious and normal. Just kidding, the president spent much of the week arguing he didn't make up the idea that Alabama would, quote, most likely be hit much harder than anticipated, unquote, by Hurricane Dorian. At the time, Dorian was not forecast to strike Alabama at all, but the president has spent the week trying to justify his claim. We'll discuss that in a moment, for better or for worse. Later in the show, David Hennig from the European Center for International Political Economy will join us to talk about what the hell is going on in Britain. And we'll also look at Walmart's choice to get out of much of the gun business a month after a very deadly mass shooting at one of its stores in Texas. But now let's bring in our Left, Right, and Center panel. As always, I'm your center. I'm joined by Rich Lowry, editor of National Review on the right. And on the left, Elizabeth Brunig of the Washington Post. Hello.
Hi, Josh.
Hey, Josh.
Liz, what have you been watching this week?
This week kicked off, as weeks often do these days, with uproar over a dumb presidential tweet. Trump expressed his concern for all the states in the path of Hurricane Dorian, including Alabama. Trouble was, the most official projections didn't have Alabama in Dorian's blast range. Vigilant tweeters called Trump out on the mistake, and Trump, being Trump, doubled down, displaying a path map for Dorian with a loop covering Alabama, suspiciously and poorly sharpied on. And while the outrage blazed about Trump's crazy antics, I couldn't help but think, this is like the 10,000th most important thing about Dorian, a historic storm whose severity is a harbinger of climate change epiphenomena to come, and whose devastation, the extent of which is not fully known, is certain to impact some of the poorest people in our national vicinity disproportionately. It's difficult to keep up the energy for aid and relief efforts when natural disasters like this happen so often, which I think is why you've heard less about the devastation of Dorian than about, say, the Haitian earthquakes. But let's hope we're able to scramble up some efforts, because it looks really bad.
So here's why I think the tweet matters. And I don't think it's for a lot of the reasons that the coverage has focused on. But it's basically, this tweet was part of the president's broader habit, where he talks about a lot of these big news events, especially natural disasters, as though he were an observer doing color commentary on the news, and pretty casual color commentary. It's not like he has the staff vetting these things to make sure the color commentary is correct. And so he says these things like he's just some cable news viewer, but he's not. He's the president communicating to the whole country. And when you're communicating about natural disasters, that's one of the places where it's really important that you get your communication right, because you want people to know whether they need to take preparatory steps or not. If you warn people about natural disasters that aren't going to hit them, that can make it harder to get people to comply with evacuation orders in the future. So this is a place where it was important for the president to be accurate, and it was more broadly, it's more important for him to take seriously when he's like, I'm going to use this mass communication channel that I have that people already were paying attention to because I was a celebrity and now are paying immense attention to because I'm president of the United States. How can I use that in a way that will protect life and protect property and help people weather this storm in the best way that they can? And it's basically an example of him not taking seriously the fact that his job has enormous implications for the lives and livelihoods of millions of people. It's just one small example of him getting it wrong and then not being able to admit that he should have done it better. That's what bothers me about it. It's not, you know, it's not so much about, oh, well, you know, why won't he just admit that he lied? Why is he creating this reality distortion field? I mean, that's annoying, but it's really, this was part of his job, and it was him doing his job really badly.
Yeah, well, he's obviously incredibly careless with his communications and has never fully graduated from the view of himself as, you know, the host of Celebrity Apprentice who can say whatever he wants. I could not bring myself to follow this one very closely. It's obviously he made a mistake, or it was what he said and tweeted was based on old forecasts, and the best thing would have just been for him to admit that, and also for the media to admit, okay, made a mistake, or is based on old forecasts, to have this you know, 5-day story, which is not just Trump digging in and not being able to admit he is a mistake. It's the media being hysterical over this small thing, and both of them being locked in this symbiotic relationship, a poisonous symbiotic relationship that's gone on for 3 years and won't stop.
Sorry, I hate to belabor this because of the way it's already been belabored this week, but the old forecast thing, like, it's true that there were previous models that had some chance of tropical storm force winds in some part of Alabama. That was supported by old forecasts. What was never supported by old forecasts was, quote, most likely to be hit much harder than anticipated, unquote. And so again,
In the tweet.
Yeah. And this is the way the president talks about everything. It's, you know, it's not just a big hurricane. It's the biggest hurricane ever. And this, in fact, you know, is one of the biggest hurricanes on record, but it was not going to be one of the biggest hurricanes ever in Alabama. And so in a lot of cases, his practice of exaggerating and hyperbole and whatever is fairly harmless. But this is a case where that instinct leads him to bad places. And so even if he was relying on an old forecast, which he shouldn't do because he's the president of the United States, he should rely on the up-to-date forecast when he's saying this thing. But the forecast never supported the thing that he said. And this is a place where it matters that he's just a person who exaggerates all the time.
Yeah, I mean, it's of a piece with his repeated statements that no one's ever heard of a Category 5 hurricane before, which is his way of saying, oh, this is a really big, bad storm. But he always, you know, amps it up to 11.
So, Liz, to your point about this distracting us from the damage that this hurricane is wreaking and has wrought, and that's something that we will know more about in the coming days. One thing I always wonder about is, you know, I think the president plays a key direct role in this communications aspect of this stuff. I wonder how much his actions are actually interfering with the quality of the response that we see on the ground when the government actually has to take actions to prepare for and respond to these sorts of storms.
Yeah, I mean, it strikes me as very likely. The administration didn't seem to do anything in particular to prepare for mounting a relief effort or anything like that. In a lot of ways, like you said, it seemed like people viewed his tweets as his contribution to a preparation effort for Americans. I think if there's a takeaway from this whole debacle, it's that there's no adult in the room here, right? If you're following the POTUS Twitter account for clear and correct information about national or international events, you're looking at the wrong source, right? That's not where you're going to find accurate information about American leadership.
But I don't think anyone does, right? I mean, ideally they should be able to, but no one does. It's not like FEMA's rushing resources to Alabama because, you know, Trump had this tweet, or people in Alabama are putting shutters on their windows. It's ideally the president's every single word would matter, but they don't now.
You don't think this affects members of the public? I don't think someone's evacuating their home because of a presidential tweet, but you don't think that this affects how much people in Alabama worry about a storm?
But then they turn on their local weather and they say the hurricane's not going to hit.
Yeah, I guess. I mean, I don't know. I also kind of wish that when he talked about the hurricane's going to hit Florida, it would have been nice if he had talked about that with more specificity. There had been worries initially that it was going to hit South Florida. By this point, it was clear it was not going to hit South Florida. That's, again, the sort of, you know, more specific information it might be good for the president to include, because, again, when people get incorrect predictions about one storm, it affects how they respond to the next one.
Yeah, I mean, granted, I mean, he should be more careful and specific, but kind of everyone knows he's not, and everyone in the government knows he's not, and it's goes to this bizarre disconnect we talked about before, where the president says things but doesn't necessarily affect what anyone's doing.
Rich, what were you watching this week?
Well, there was a big, speaking of the climate, big climate forum on CNN for hours and hours. Democrats talking about the threat of climate change. And I just think this is, in sheer political terms, is a trap for Democrats where they risk getting caught in their own bubble. Polling shows that people are more inclined to believe that there's a man-made element to global warming, more inclined to be alarmed by it. But still, once you get to imposing a cost or an element of coercion to people, I just think that's not going to sell. And if Trump manages to thread the needle and be reelected, that a Democratic candidate being too far out on the limb on this issue, I believe probably be a contributing factor.
Liz, what did you make of what we heard at the climate forum?
I mean, I think that the number one thing to note about the climate forum is that the party is shaping up and actually starting to deliver specific, practicable plans for responding to climate change. So, for instance, Bernie Sanders has floated the idea of a Green Tennessee Valley Authority, this New Deal public agency that produces energy, and that way the government could directly control energy production through this particular agency, at least, and reduce emissions. I think that's at least practicable, right? It's not dreamy. It's not unspecific, as other Democrats, even in this process, have alleged about climate change response plans. And so I think it signals that the party is starting to take this subject really seriously, and not just Jay Inslee. And I think that's key to selling it. There will be costs. Life will have to change in order for climate change to be rolled back or controlled. There's no way around that. And I think that serious policies being debated by serious politicians is a way to start acclimating people to the idea that things are going to have to change a little in order to maintain our stability in the long run.
So do you worry about what Rich described there, that this becomes less popular when you start putting concrete costs on it? I mean, one thing you heard repeatedly at the forum was Republicans say, we're going to take away your hamburgers. We're not going to take away your hamburgers, although in between the lines or sometimes more explicitly, it was, you know, these policies will make your hamburgers more expensive at the margin. When you add those things up, things that increase the cost of energy, things that will push people to make changes in their lifestyle, do you think Rich is right to think that that reduces the popularity of these proposals?
It almost always reduces popularity of proposals when you start talking about their costs. I do think it's possible to rebound from that, however. The important thing is to highlight how climate change is already costing people money. So when they have to pay for damage caused by these unusual climate events that are related to climate change, and I think Dorian's a good case in point, although it probably hasn't affected Americans as much as the Bahamas, I mean, certainly hasn't affected America as much as the Bahamas, you can tell people, look, you're going to pay some in taxes, but ultimately it'll save you money in that you won't have to contend with the enormous costs of climate change.
Rich, I think we're starting to see that to an extent in Florida, which is the state where you see Republicans sort of most inclined to break out from the party's positions on climate change. I mean, they're seeing the rampant flooding in places like Miami Beach, and you're seeing the real on-the-ground costs there. I guess the question for me is whether you get that feeling nationally in places that aren't as low-lying and wet as Florida.
No. I mean, why would you? And I mean, there's been no trend, just to hit on Dorian again, there's no observable trend in hurricanes last century in terms of landfall, intensity, any of that. So it will be that hurricanes are affected by the climate in all sorts of ways. But this, I'm a broken record on this, but it's simplistic and goes beyond the science to say any unwelcome weather event or big weather event is caused by climate change. It's just not supported.
What there is a big upward trend in is the cost of the damage imposed by these storms. And a lot of that has to do with what expensive things get constructed where. And some of that is a matter of public policy. I mean, you see the government, you know, subsidizing forms of insurance that encourage people to build their homes where they're going to get destroyed by hurricanes. And so it seems to me that there's room to talk about that. And it's not but then again, that gets you into positions where people, you know, they want solutions that will protect them from climate change, but they don't want to necessarily be told, you know, well, you're going to have to pay more for homeowners insurance if you want to live in the path of a hurricane.
Yeah, well, this is the case of people who, you know, would be most directly affected, not wanting to pay more because no one wants to pay more for anything. And Congress hasn't done anything to, you know, adjust the insurance rates for people building in these coastal areas.
One thing that I was interested in with regard to this climate forum was that it happened at all and the way in which it happened. I mean, obviously there was this effort that was successful in a way, even though it didn't get exactly what it was asking for, pushing for a debate specific to climate change among Democratic candidates. The Democratic National Committee, which sanctions all the debates, didn't allow it and was pretty clearly not going to allow it all along. But the DNC doesn't control forums where the candidates don't directly engage each other. And so the solution was CNN and the candidates were able to get together and agree on having this 7-hour forum, much longer than any debate would have been. MSNBC is going to have another one in a couple of weeks. And I think this was a pretty good solution in a couple of ways. One was that because of that longer format, it wasn't so soundbite focused, allowed the candidates to get more detailed on an issue where really you do need a lot of time to get into a lot of detail to elucidate the differences between the candidates. But it also made me think that maybe this would be a good way to do the debates themselves. I think the DNC's really valid objection to approving a climate debate had to do with, well, if we approve a debate on climate, how do we decide what other issues should get their own debates? Because there are activists around a wide variety of issues in the party, each of whom think that their issue is of paramount importance and deserves its own debate. And then mostly unspoken, although you did hear this aloud a little bit, was that basically these issue-specific debates can then become an opportunity for activists to extract policy commitments out of the candidates that are popular among voters in the Democratic primary or among particularly active slices of voters in the Democratic primary who would be unpopular in a general election. Basically, it becomes a way to force the candidates to the left in certain ways that could harm the party politically. But the only reason the DNC has to consider that is that the DNC has put itself in this position of regulating the debates. Approving debates is inherently a gatekeeper role. If people don't want the party to act as a gatekeeper, it shouldn't be the organization that commissions the debates. And until just a few years ago, it wasn't. The debates were formed by candidates negotiating directly with TV networks and other media outlets, and that was how you decided what there would be a debate on. That would give you the limiting principle on which issues should get debates. It would be whichever issues the candidates and the media outlets agreed there would be debates on. And it would also give us a way to avoid this nonsense with 17 candidates on stage. The DNC doesn't want to be in the business of imposing a stringent rule on who's really a serious candidate. There are good reasons why the party doesn't want to do that, but if they didn't run the debates, they wouldn't have to. They could let the TV networks do that for them. Liz, what do you think about that? Would you want to see the DNC out of the debate business?
Yeah, I support anything that leads to a more anarchic debate structuring procedure. I think that the DNC is already an organization that is at least mistrusted by a flank of the party. And so keeping it out of the debate schedule, it would keep a cleaner procedure for the primaries, I think.
This has been a change on the Republican side, too, almost exactly in parallel, where the RNC took over this process to try to make the debates less chaotic. It didn't seem to work.
Yeah, so there was basically a candidate revolt, I guess it all runs together, 2012, and they had so many debates that the candidates feel they couldn't schedule other things, and they became repetitive, and nothing new was developed, and then the RNC tried to take over, and you know, it was that clean process everyone remembers in 2016. So you know, it's a balance. I generally favor more discussions rather than less, and a greater variety of forums. I do think, even though you know it's kind of ridiculous to call it a debate, but with the 10 candidates standing there together, you do get moments and you do see contrasts, and it's useful. But there's also definitely a place for this climate change forum as well, which you can actually, you know, you're not limited to one stage, so you can broaden it to more candidates and really delve into issues in a way you can't, you know, in a 30-second soundbite on a debate stage. So the more the merrier, but within limits, because if you had, you know, a couple of these every week, the candidates would be driven crazy.
Before we take a break, I want to briefly share some news about Left, Right, and Center. It involves Left, Right, and Center merchandise. As you may have heard, KCRW is in the middle of a fundraising season. I'm sure you're used to t-shirts and tote bags and coffee mugs. You know the public radio drill. Well, this season, we have something special for you as a Left, Right, and Center fan. We made you a hat. It's a baseball cap, and it says civilized yet provocative on the front. You can see a photo of it on the LRC KCRW Twitter feed, and it can be yours if you become a KCRW member at $10 a month or more. When you become a KCRW member, you're supporting Left, Right, and Center and all the other great shows from KCRW, and let me tell you, we really appreciate your support. So please consider becoming a civilized yet provocative KCRW member with a very fashionable hat. Go to kcrw.com/join, and thanks for your support. I'll be back with Rich Lowry of National Review and Elizabeth Brunig of The Washington Post to talk about Brexit. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
What do you think? Share your thoughts on today's show on our Facebook page or tweet us at LRCKCRW and download the KCRW app to listen to Left, Right, and Center on demand.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm Josh Barrow of New York Magazine. On the right is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review. On the left is Elizabeth Brunig, columnist at The Washington Post. Prime Minister Boris Johnson is trying to take the United Kingdom out of the European Union. His predecessor, Theresa May, was also trying to do that, but maybe not hard enough in the view of Conservative Party members who made Johnson their new leader. Johnson's strategy as the new prime minister has been to make a threat that May wasn't quite willing to make. He will lead Britain out of the EU by the end of October, whether or not there is a deal over exit terms. That is, he's willing to make the hard Brexit, and he's willing to do it on a date certain, which happens to be Halloween. Johnson's brinkmanship has drawn resistance, not just from opposition parties, but from a significant chunk of his own party. And over his objections, Parliament voted to force Johnson to request an extension past October 31 for more time to negotiate if he hasn't reached a deal by then. Johnson's upset. He says this undermines his leverage, that he can't force the EU to deal if they know they can stall. But his opponents worry about the damage to Britain's economy and to peace in Northern Ireland if the country leaves the EU without a deal. Johnson expelled about 24 members of his own party for voting to thwart his will on this issue, giving up his own parliamentary majority, and now he wants a new election to see if he can get his majority back. But it's not clear how soon he can get one. To discuss all that, we're joined now by David Hennick. David joins us from London, where he's the director of the UK Trade Policy Project at the European Centre for International Political Economy. David also founded the UK Trade Project, a nonpartisan group for debating post-Brexit trade policy. Welcome, David.
Hi, how are you?
Good. So I know some Americans have been watching some of the recent proceedings in the UK Parliament, which is not a thing that Americans normally do much of. And we've been watching with a little bit of befuddlement. This is not how your system normally works, right?
Well, first of all, I can reassure anybody watching with a sense of befuddlement that we're also watching with a certain sense of befuddlement as well. So you're not alone in that. No, this is normally this is not how things work. Normally, we have a prime minister who, unlike the president, our prime minister can normally do whatever they want to do. This is a new experience for us that our prime minister is saying, I want to do this. And Parliament's saying, well, we don't want to let you. And this has been happening repeatedly. It happened to Theresa May. It is now happening to Boris Johnson. And we're not quite sure where it's all going to end up.
Well, and there's a double novelty of this, right? Where not only is Parliament not giving him what he wants, but then when he says, okay, well, let's have a new election so we can see if we can elect a new government that will let me do this, it's not clear they're going to allow him to have that election either, right?
So there's not a lot of trust around here. So as you say, the date when we were going to leave the European Union was set at October the 31st. Johnson says we're leaving do or die on that day. Now a bill has been passed to say if there's no deal with the EU, we can't leave on that day. And the reason that the opposition won't give him an election is they don't trust that if there's an election, he won't set the date for October the 31st and then refuse to implement what they said. So there's a kind of stalemate here. There will be an election soon. There will be an election within the next 3 months, I think, in the UK, but possibly after we've got an extension, or we wait to see really what is going to happen next.
So as we do that waiting and seeing, and we don't know exactly what a Brexit or a post-Brexit situation would look like, one key talking point that we've been hearing both from Boris Johnson and then also from our president, Donald Trump, is that Brexit creates an opportunity for a new trade deal between the UK and the US and maybe even for a very favorable trade deal. What do you see as the prospects for trade between the US and the UK if we do have Brexit?
Well, there's already a great trade relationship between us. We're huge investors in each other's countries. So the first thing to always say about this is we do loads of trade already. Now, President Trump always says it's going to be the greatest deal ever. Boris Johnson, who some say has some similarities to President Trump, is saying it's going to be a great deal as well. Actually, it's going to be quite tricky because we've started on this side ruling out all the things that you might want, like access to a national health service or to for your farmers to be able to export their products to us. And it's pretty well known that on the US side, you're not a big fan of opening up your markets like, you know, Buy America or the Jones Act. So it all looks like we could say it's going to be the greatest deal ever. We're struggling to work out how it's going to be the greatest deal ever.
Yeah, Rich, what do you make of that? It seems, I mean, first of all, we've seen the president seek to negotiate some of these trade deals around the world. The negotiation he got done on with Canada and Mexico ended up with some very small bore changes and then hasn't even been ratified, may not ever actually become law. And it seems like there are a lot of things that you might expect the U.S. to ask for under any president, even who wasn't Donald Trump, as David notes, some things that might be big sticking points in the U.K. So when the president talks big about the idea of a big trade deal, does that sound like something that's plausible to you, and does that sound like something the U.K. should be counting on?
It's plausible. It's just not easy. And this is one reason, you know, trade skeptics kind of in the Trump wing of the party don't like multilateral trade deals. But one reason to do them is if you're going to actually do one of these deals, they're so hard, there's so many difficult details, do it a big bang at once. It's harder actually to do these rifle shots country to country. So I think it makes a lot of strategic sense. It'd be great to do. It's just not going to be easy, and it's not going to be an instant relief from any trade disruption from exiting the EU. And, you know, we had a show a couple months ago on parliamentary systems and how much more efficient they are than ours. They don't have gridlock. And that's supposed to be because once you lose your governing majority in parliament, you have an election. And now you have the screwy system in the UK where Dan McLaughlin, one of my colleagues, put it well in a tweet. The Conservatives have lost parliament, whereas Labour has lost the people or has reason to fear an election. So Labour doesn't want an election. The Conservatives want an election, and Labour can block the election. At the same time, the longer they block the election, the more the conservatives are supposed to be governing but can't. So that's just the situation they're stuck in. But it's not sustainable. There has to be an election soon.
Yeah, Liz, I mean, another stumbling block for the idea that we would have some great trade deal between the U.S. and the U.K. is that, as the president learned the hard way with regard to Canada and Mexico, is this stuff has to be approved by Congress, and that means that you need approval from a lot of Democrats. And Democrats sort of have their own wish list on trade that would be quite different from the already extensive list that the Trump administration would have. And then you also have Democrats who feel very negatively about Brexit at the same time the president is favorable toward it, very concerned about how it's going to affect the situation between Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland. And so they're talking about, you know, what Democrats would need to look for in terms of a trade deal. I mean, what should Democrats be asking for if we're trying to set up a new relationship between the U.S. and the U.K. that is a post-EU relationship?
I mean, it's complicated and it's difficult to say, especially because there are Democrats with wildly divergent views on trade, even in Congress. So you have some Democrats who favor a more open trade relationship and open trade generally. And then you have other Democrats who are more skeptical of those kinds of arrangements. And those two branches are actually vying for dominance in the party right now. You can see it in the primaries, and it's certainly going to come to a head. So, I mean, I think you always try to aim trade at humane, humanitarian goals. You try to limit the damage that it does to workers on both sides, and you center them as your priority. But like I said, it's up in the air how Democrats are going to come out at the end of the next election we have, which makes Brexit even more uncertain.
David, can you talk a little bit about this stumbling block with regard to Northern Ireland? For Americans who aren't completely familiar, the Republic of Ireland, which is most of the island, is independent. Northern Ireland, which is part of the UK, they currently have a completely open border between them. They're both part of the EU. They have a customs union that they participate in, and so you can just drive straight across that border, both by yourself and with goods. If Britain leaves the EU, it presumably won't be in that customs union anymore, so they would need some sort of way to establish checks at that border, but it's been a really important part of the peace process in Ireland that you have that open border, even as those two parts of the island are part of separate countries. Has there been any movement toward a solution there? Because the one that had been talked about, the so-called backstop, would basically have either the entire United Kingdom or at least Northern Ireland remain within the customs union of the European Union, but that means giving up a lot of control over your trade policy, and I gather part of the whole point of Brexit was to reassert that control. Is there any way to do that without establishing a hard border in Ireland that nobody professes to want?
So with a great deal of difficulty is the honest answer, and not in any short space of time. So what you need to understand about Northern Ireland is there are two communities there. There is what's called a nationalist community who see themselves very much as Irish. There is a unionist community see themselves very much as part of the UK, and there were troubles there. There was conflict there until 1998. There was a treaty, the Good Friday Agreement, and what that really did was it allowed people to feel like whatever they wanted to be. If you wanted to feel Irish, there's no border down to Ireland. You can trade entirely freely. If you want to feel part of the UK, that's fine as well. There's no border between Northern Ireland and the rest of the UK. So that all works fine. Now, as soon as you put customs procedures on top of that or checks on produce, it's partly about customs. We want trade policy. We want to be able to change our own tariffs. It's partly about checks. It's partly about whether we have the same standards of animal products. These are the things that get tested a lot at borders. And that's where it starts getting complicated with the US angle. So if we allow US food standards into the UK, which the EU does not, the EU says we'll need to check those things at the Irish border. And that's where it gets complicated. That's where you have Speaker Pelosi saying we can't have that deal because that would risk the peace. And in terms of other ideas, there are lots of ideas going around. Lots of people have been trying to make borders more seamless for years. And maybe you could work something between you over time. But in terms of doing something on November the 1st, if we leave on October the 31st without a deal, no chance. There's no border in the world outside the European Union that doesn't have some kind of infrastructure. And most borders, let's be honest, have huge amounts of infrastructure, have huge queues for goods checks, and paying your customs and paying taxes. It's hard to see where you go with that. So this is not an easy thing to solve. It's caused even worse problems by some people saying it's easy to solve. The US trade deal sits directly on top of it. It's quite a mess, if I'm being honest with you, and nobody quite knows where it's going to. The only thing we now know from this week, if I can just one more point, the only thing we now know from this week is the Republic of Ireland have finally said if there is a no-deal Brexit, they will have to make checks on products coming into the country.
Rich, isn't this a reason to temper enthusiasm for Brexit? I mean, there are a lot of complications created by Brexit, and most of them sound to me like things where, you know, with a certain amount of effort and a certain amount of disruption initially, you ought to be able to figure out, you know, agreements on, you know, cross-border trade between the UK and mainland Europe and how financial services would work and all these sorts of things. I have not seen anyone advance what sounds like a really good solution for the Irish border that does not involve some sort of granting of authority from the United Kingdom to the EU more broadly of authority over some area of trade and agricultural and various other policies. It doesn't seem to me like there's a way to have a satisfactorily open approach to the Irish border without some ongoing relationship with the EU that is much deeper than the Brexiteers want.
In principle, I am an extremist on Brexit. I've strongly supported it all along. I think any disruption or complications are worth it in the fullness of history to have the UK fully take back its sovereignty. But as a practical matter, this would begin to feel a lot to me like Obamacare repeal, where once the first delay was really the warning sign for me. Once these things get delayed, the natural path is to keep delaying. And it seems to me that Boris Johnson, to make his plan work, has to, you know, have a real strong parliamentary majority in favor of a no-deal Brexit, which is the only hope of actually getting a deal that the Brexiteers would consider worth it. And that prospect seems very foggy to me.
But even if you had that, what would that mean for Ireland?
Well, I think it could be worked out, but it's hugely complicated. And I do not have a worked out position on that myself, because every Brit I talk to doesn't really know what to do either.
But doesn't that tell you something? I mean, that seems...
It's a huge complication. There's no doubt about it.
Liz, I mean, one thing this intractable problem over the Irish border raises for me is that if you want this sort of international openness that a lot of people on the left would like, and borders that people can just sort of freely cross, and so that you can have a place that is united in the way that Ireland is now, even when it is not actually all part of the same country, you sort of need these internationalist neoliberal institutions that create these overarching rules that make it possible to have that kind of open border. So isn't that something that the left needs to get comfortable with in a way that it often hasn't been with regard to the EU?
Well, it depends on who guides the policies, right? I mean, you can certainly have institutions like the EU that end up protecting the rights of capital at the expense of the rights of labor. And that is a kind of, you know, quote unquote, openness that the left would argue actually produces less freedom for people who live under that regime. I don't think it's necessarily the case that more openness at the borders, more openness between countries necessarily leads to a greater control going to capital. But you have to legislate against it. I mean, it's something that you have to take into account consciously when you're constructing these plans. And like Rich said, this is just kind of degenerating, it looks like, into a debacle without any clear story coming out as to how things would look upon departure from the EU.
David, can you give us a sense of what you think we should expect? And obviously, you don't have a crystal ball, you don't know, but you suggested you think it's likely we're going to have an election, but maybe not until after October 31st. So then are you suggesting there would, in fact, be a delay of the UK's exit from the EU past October 31st? How long should we expect that delay to be? And then what should we expect the UK government to do with that additional time that it'll have?
All predictions on Brexit are complicated. I mean, one thing just before going on to that is to say about the EU and the UK's relationship, there are people on the right who love the EU and people on the right who hate the EU and people on the left who love it and people on the left who hate it. And that's one of the real complications here. It goes again across all political lines. Now, in the UK, there is a reasonable majority that say we shouldn't leave without a deal. And I think that will hold until the end of October. So I think that the EU will give us an extension for maybe 3 or 6 months while we hold an election. There is going to be an election. The biggest problem we then face is that nobody looking at the numbers thinks that the election will lead to a really big majority for the Conservatives at the moment. I can reassure Rich, who's been writing about the perils of our leader of the opposition, Jeremy Corbyn, that it's pretty unlikely he's going to win a majority either. The most likely is that we're going to be stuck again with no party having single control. And then, you know, after that, it will all be down to, you know, specific numbers. If there are just about the numbers to leave with a deal, then we can perhaps start negotiating better. We haven't negotiated very well, as you may have seen. We're still not negotiating particularly well. So if there's the numbers to do it, maybe we'll start negotiating better. And if the Conservatives do manage to win a majority, which is possible, then I think we will now leave without a deal. But I think that the date goes back from October the 31st. I think we're now looking into early next year. And I think that the election is, in effect, another referendum on leaving the EU or staying close to it. That is going to be the referendum. That is the one to watch. It will probably take place in November.
David Hennig is director of the UK Trade Policy Project at the European Centre for International Political Economy and the founder of the UK Trade Project. David, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Still with me are on the left, Liz Brunig of The Washington Post, and on the right, Rich Lowry of National Review. And now it's time for Tweets of the Week. Sometimes it only takes 140 characters or maybe 280 to distill the spirit of the week. Liz Brunig, what's your Tweet of the Week?
From reporter Matt Garahan, the BBC is reporting that the Conservative government may put forward a vote of no confidence in itself. Who amongst us?
Rich Lowry, what tweet struck you?
My tweet is from a guy named Gabriel Maller, and he tweeted about the conventional wisdom among Democrats that Stacey Abrams should be rightfully the governor of Georgia right now. And he tweeted, there's no evidence that Stacey Abrams would be governor of Georgia right now absent voter suppression. This conspiracy theory on the left is as nutty and evidence-free as Trump's claim that he would have won the popular vote absent voter fraud.
My tweet of the week is from Ray Dalio, the billionaire founder of the hugely successful hedge fund Bridgewater Associates, who has a very unique management philosophy built around radical transparency. Basically, you're supposed to tell people what you think about them at all times. It's a company that a certain kind of person can work at very successfully, but most people would just find incredibly stressful. He tweets, just back from Burning Man. Reminds me of Woodstock with better art installations and less good music. What a great vibe and what amazing community. I don't know what else to say about this other than I'm not sure whether radical transparency would be an excellent philosophy for Burning Man or a terrible philosophy. I've been talking with Rich Lowry of National Review and Elizabeth Brunig of The Washington Post. We will be back to talk about Walmart and guns. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
Join the conversation on our Facebook page or tweet us at LRCKCRW. Stream all episodes of Left, Right, and Center and other great shows at kcrw.com/podcasts.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm your host, Josh Barrow. On the right is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review. On the left is Elizabeth Brunig, columnist at The Washington Post. Walmart announced some changes to its policies on guns this week. It's going to sell much less ammunition than it used to. It will no longer sell ammunition for handguns, and it won't sell certain rifle ammunition that's appropriate for use in assault weapons. And while Walmart mostly stopped selling handguns in the 1990s, it will discontinue their sale in the last state where it still sells them, which is Alaska. The company will also ask customers not to openly carry firearms in its stores unless they're law enforcement officers. Rich, how should we think about actions like this by private companies? Tucker Carlson is outraged. To what extent is it our concern what Walmart decides to sell or not sell?
Well, in principle, it's a private company can sell or not sell whatever it wants. The conservative disquiet is the fear that pressure on these companies will be ways to achieve, in effect, legislative ends that can't be won through popularly elected assemblies. I don't see this as hugely consequential. It's not as though people aren't going to be able to buy ammunition and open carry, you know, the places in the country where you won't blink if you see someone openly carrying a weapon. But carrying one into a store like this is doesn't seem necessary, and it's obnoxious, and especially now would freak people out.
Liz, I mean, to Rich's point, a lot of pressure groups on the left that, you know, historically might have focused more of their efforts on the government directly, they seem to share the view of the right that it is important from a public policy perspective, from a social change perspective, to change actions of corporations like this. And a lot of them have been very pleased about Walmart's decision.
Yeah, I mean, I think that you're starting to see much more of corporations moving the needle based on pressure they're getting from consumers than you do see the government responding to voters. I think this has been the case in several domains, in trans rights most recently. And it's certainly something that's happening now with guns. I mean, I think it's important to realize that this is a worst case scenario for the right and left, right? The right because of the fact that it's on the other side of much of public opinion right now. So the right is taking hits when corporations are responsive to left consumer protest. But I think it's also the case that corporations change based on consumer will, and consumer will is highly variable. So the left can't come to rely on this as a strategy. We still need politics and political organizing because corporations still are not ultimately in the left's corner. They might be able to bat for the left on social issues when it doesn't cost them hugely, but they're not going to bat for the left when it comes to, say, organized labor, right? Because that's very costly for them. So they're not our friend. They're not our ally. There might be a temporary use of them. But I don't think it's a relationship that should become overly cozy.
I think another thing that's disquieting about this for conservatives is that, while the electorate is disproportionately older and disproportionately whiter than the country as a whole, when you look at who corporations care about, obviously it depends on specifically what product or service they're selling, but they tend to be interested in an average, a consumer who is on average younger than the average voter is. I mean, for one thing, under 18s don't matter at all for voting. They do matter somewhat for corporations. They tend to think that younger consumers and more urban areas are tastemakers. They focus on them to whether or not that's accurate or not, that is reflected in their advertising and marketing strategies. So I think, Rich, one thing is that it's a different subset of the country that's empowered when the focus is on consumer behavior rather than voting behavior.
Right. It doesn't matter whether they're showing up at the voting booth. It doesn't matter how they're geographically distributed around the country the way it does for the Electoral College and congressional apportionment. All that's true. I think what this may augur is a more comprehensively negative attitude towards corporations from both sides, with the left don't like them for economic reasons, and the right increasingly is not going to like them for social reasons.
Although I don't know. I mean, there was that Georgetown poll last year about most trusted institutions in the United States, and it found that they polled 20 things like, big banks and the military and unions and the media and all these things. And the most trusted institution by Democrats was Amazon. But Amazon was also number three with Republicans. And so overall, Google also scored very well in the survey. It depends which corporation you're asking about. People, they don't rate big business broadly, very well, but some specific corporations that people have extensive consumer interactions with, they're a lot more likely to talk positively about than other institutions in society. So I don't know whether that's flowing through. I in part because I think most people are not quite as politicized as the loudest people talking about, why they're not eating at Chick-fil-A or why they're throwing away their Nike sneakers or whatever. One thing I was interested in with this Walmart story is I think it was a little different from the Nike and Chick-fil-A and other stories where people are really concerned about, does this corporation reflect my social values? I'm sure that's part of what animated Walmart here, and as gun control activists have gotten more politically activated over the last few years. But also, I mean, the Washington Post had a story a few days after the shooting in El Paso, and they interviewed a Walmart worker in California who was saying, we're all afraid we're going to die, and we're looking for, where we can hide in the store. And so I suspect the company was responding mostly to that sort of feedback from employees rather than customers, that, they're concerned about where the next mass shooting is going to be. They don't like all these people showing up in the store, showing off their rifles, walking around, making people worried that somebody's going to shoot someone. And so I think, this people are almost overthinking this in terms of a political decision. I think this is, especially in a tight labor market where Walmart needs to worry about keeping its workers happy, it's been put in the situation where people are afraid of getting shot at Walmart. They need to send messages that, no, you're not going to get shot at Walmart.
Yeah, so Walmart, at least for the moment, people are thinking about that like a school, in terms of being a target for a shooting. And the open carry, the way that Walmart framed it was actually, it was fairly minimalistic, right? It says, this is our respectful request. which seems entirely reasonable to me.
Although we'll see what happens if that, you know, draws testing from open carry activists who you know, say, well, you didn't prohibit me, I'm going to go show up and see what happens. I think this is a major problem for gun rights activists. I think that this really does not play well with the public, and I think there almost needs to be a respectability politics among gun rights mm-hmm. activists, basically telling people, stop doing this. This isn't good for the movement. Liz, I know you wrote this week about sort of the increasing worry that people are feeling in public places.
Yeah, I mean, it's something that's occurred to me more and more, especially because I've become a parent in the age of mass shootings. So I can remember in high school feeling some concern. I went to a really large high school. There were thousands of students at it. And I was concerned periodically with especially certain kids that I had classes with. I'd be like, damn, I need to sit close to the door or something. Now with my kids, when I go in public places, you know, the subway platform at rush hour, when there are tons and tons of people, movie theater for a big movie that's coming out, I'm very vigilant about, you know, where are the exits? What's my path of escape? And that's something that I don't like. I don't like having to factor the possibility that the event that I'm planning to take my kids to will be, you know, a killing field. But it's something you have to think about, right? Because it's not just schools, it's not just post offices anymore. It's hard to bracket in that way. It's anywhere lots of people are gathered, and in some really innocent, really mundane settings, even outdoors, like the Garlic Festival. So I do think that's something that's starting to press on people, and as you mentioned, something that's starting to press on employees in their capacity as workers, right? I mean, if you're working at Walmart and you know that these shootings have happened, what's it like watching someone come in open carry, right? It's going to immediately terrify you.
Yeah, I mean, we talked a couple of weeks ago about Neil deGrasse Tyson and the thing he said that drew so much negative reaction, where he was pointing out all these things that are likelier to kill you than a mass shooting. And I worry about the same things Liz worries about, but that's actually part of what I try to tell myself, is that statistically this stuff is very unlikely. But at the same time, these sorts of things that are rare events, but they're very high-profile events, people do worry about them. And rich people, you know, they demand reactions both from the government and from institutions like Walmart to try to protect them from these perceived high-profile risks. And so I think, you know, that's, you know, if this is a feeling that people have, I think we need to recognize a certain validity in that.
Yeah. So, you know, rationally, statistically, it's one thing, but I'm with both of you. It's there inexorably in the back of your mind in almost any large gathering. It's just I come back to there just not being a ready public policy solution, one. And two, the fact that we're all thinking about it and we're all discussing it and schools are, you know, being hardened against it may perversely, you know, increase the potency of this cultural meme that this is something that happens and something that people on the edge might consider. And I don't know how you get out of that spiraling dynamic either.
Rich, you wrote this week about gun ownership being a God-given right, and this was a national controversy because a state representative from Texas had written shortly in the aftermath of yet another mass shooting in West Texas that there was such a God-given right. So what does it mean for there to be a God-given right to gun ownership?
Well, I think there's a natural right clearly to self-defense, and you know, it's basically the American creed that our natural rights come from our God-given rights. It says that in the Declaration, and to have a natural right to self-defense means it needs to be effectual. And, you know, in the modern era, last several centuries, that implies a right to gun ownership. Now, that doesn't mean that every jot and tittle of our current gun regime is divinely mandated. It doesn't mean God wants you to own an AR-15. But I think that anything that went so far as to impinge on an individual's right to get a gun would be a violation of this natural right.
But so what does that mean in terms of the specifics? Because both, you know, within the U.S. and then in other countries, there's such wide variation in terms of what the legal regime is around that. And every, you know, advanced democratic country has protection of life in some manner as a, right. as an explicit or policy goal. Are countries like the U.K. and Japan against God when they make it nearly impossible for people to have guns in their homes?
I think they're denying a natural right. Doesn't mean they're tyrannies. The same way, you know, the UK, you tweet something that violates a hate law, you'll get a visit by a police. I think that's a violation of your liberty. It doesn't make Britain a tyranny. I think our gun regime under the Second Amendment makes us a freer country, but there's obviously downsides to that as well.
Liz, what do you make of that?
Well, I don't think there's a lot of ammunition. Well, I studied theology for my master's at the University of Cambridge, Christian theology, and I don't see articulated in any of the traditional Christian thinkers an individual right, a subjective right to the ownership of a gun. I think that would require one to say that the government is obligated to distribute guns in order to meet the demands of justice, or would at least imply something like that. So that strikes me as a little absurd. I see the traditional Christian thinkers as thinking less in terms of subjective individual rights and more in terms of an objective right of order. But even if you take all of that to be fair and licit, then the question is, why assault weapons and why not nuclear weapons? Why not everyone has the right to have a suitcase nuke? I mean, because you have to have efficacious self-defense, and who knows what could happen to you. And the fact is, yes, Christians have a right to self-defense, if we're talking about Christian theology, which is the only thing I have any expertise in. Yes, it should be efficacious. Christians should never aim to kill, even in self-defense, right? The defense of self should never take on an intent to kill. That would be morally wrong. So you know, you can get down to, okay, so why not everyone just has, like, you know, a single action shotgun or something, you know, something that's hard to fire repeatedly quickly into a crowd in a way that has happened again and again.
Rich, I mean, to that point, you acknowledge in your column that that the right that you're positing doesn't create a right necessarily to every specific kind of firearm, that the gun control measures that are usually discussed within the United States could work within this framework. But my question then is, if it's that flexible, if the terms on which the government has to allow self-defense can be flexible in that ways, why can't they flex to a regime where people broadly can't own guns? I mean, if you have another country that has achieved a lower murder rate than the United States, why doesn't that show that that country has had greater success at allowing people to protect themselves than the United States has, even if that country has a more restrictive gun ownership regime?
Well, I think, one, we're a really big country. We're, unfortunately, even subtracting from guns, a violent country, which makes us different. American exceptionalism, conservatives talk about it a lot. It's not just positive side ledger. There's a negative part of it as well. And there's a case, the young woman last couple of days in Houston who was in a garage and five guys, you know, assaulted her in her car, and we're going to rob her or maybe do worse. And she took out a gun and shot them. And I think she had a natural right to do that. I think you can have all sorts of restrictions on guns. You could even ban all semi-automatic weapons. I think probably runs afoul of the Second Amendment, but let's put that aside. But if you're going to go so far down that there's absolutely no firearm that she can own and use to equalize her against five guys who are presumably bigger than her, who mean her harm, then I think you're violating a natural right.
It seems like there are probably non-lethal means for self-protection in that case, like a taser or mace. And it also seems to me that the studies reflect that women having guns specifically to protect themselves from men run a high risk of the bigger, stronger male taking the gun out of your hand and turning it on you.
We've reached that time once again for our famed Left, Right, and Center rants featuring pet peeves from across the political spectrum. Rich Lowry, it's your soapbox.
I think we should take a moment to note the sad descent of Beto O'Rourke, who went from the next hot thing in Democratic politics, standing on countertops all across the country, to a 1-2% candidate who is increasingly foul-mouthed and radical in his desperation for attention. He's going into that good night, but not gently or gracefully.
Liz Brunick, what's your rant?
I think the CNN town hall was pretty helpful in terms of getting to voters what different candidates in the Democratic primary are thinking about climate change, an extremely momentous issue. And I think it drove home just how craven the DNC was in refusing to put on a debate about the issue. The candidates didn't really get to engage each other, which was a loss for voters.
For my rant, I want to note that Howard Schultz has decided not to run for president. He said his potential campaign got less traction with moderate voters than he expected, and that he didn't want to help re-elect Donald Trump. I could have told Schultz this would happen before he spent so much money on consultants trying to figure it out. Moderate voters do exist, but they're not mostly like Schultz, which is to say socially liberal and moderate on economic issues. They're a lot more likely to be more socially conservative and more economically liberal, but that's not a fashionable viewpoint in the media or in the sorts of wealthy circles where people decide whether they're going to spend hundreds of millions of dollars on a presidential campaign. The U.S. system is not conducive to third-party candidates. I don't think anybody was going to be able to run up the middle between Donald Trump and whoever the Democrats nominate. But if somebody was going to be able to do it, it was never going to be Howard Schultz. That's all we have time for today. I want to thank Rich Lowry, Liz Brunig, and David Hennig. Left, Right, and Center is produced by Sarah Fay. Our technical director is JC Swadek. Colin Cab Washington is our production assistant. Todd M. Simon composed our theme music. I'm Josh Barrow. Thanks for joining us, and tune in next week for more Left, Right, and Center.
Download and subscribe at kcrw.com/LRC, the KCRW app, or wherever you find podcasts. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW.